this summer. Some members of my extended family got together with a facilitator to try to resolve a fight. The fight had been festering for over a year, and I won't wade too far into the specifics, but it centered around two people, friends with certain members of my family, who are known to spread around opinions that other members of my family think are hateful, especially opinions about whether it's okay to be gay. Some of the people I love best in the world are gay. The fact that anybody in my family would associate with people whose public statements risked the safety and well-being of people I love was intolerable to me. So when I learned of those public statements, I did the natural thing, wrote an extremely angry email to my entire family, calling out their friends and their harmful and wrong opinions, as one does. In the family I grew up with, togetherness was very important. There was generally a right answer to every question, and it was assumed that everybody would agree on it. The story we told one another about ourselves was that we love one another, we're super tight, we get along. And for this story to be true, it required a fair bit of conflict avoidance. Loving one another meant, in some sense, that we didn't disagree about important things. So you can imagine how my email went over. There is a particular vision of the early church that kind of maps on to my family's ideal of what closeness is. It's in Acts, and there are these memorable passages that paint an extremely rosy picture of early communal life in the church. The apostles pray with a single purpose. The community had everything in common. They're eating together joyfully, and they're giving away everything they own and going out and doing good works as a united front, almost as if they like share a single brain. We're living now, though, through a time when it actually feels impossible that people will agree on anything most of the time. It feels like for the past few years, we've been in this like perpetual Advent moment, like just this dark time where we can't find our way out of it except by some miracle. A lot of people in this country can't agree on what is true and what is fiction. Conspiracy theories are taken as truth, largely in conservative spaces, but sometimes also in liberal or progressive ones. I guess that the vast majority of Americans are part of a family or a community that has in some way been shaken by these dynamics. Mine was. It became impossible to continue to believe that my family agreed on everything. And this question then arose, like, if we didn't agree, did we love one another? And like, how could we? And what would that look like? In this context, that Acts ideal just felt like totally irrelevant to me. I didn't want some utopia where everybody magically agreed. I wanted a map for how to live in community that was just messier and more real. How do we get along when people are having the same argument for the 100th time? When they're struggling to keep heads above water, when they're strapped for cash, when they're burnt out, wondering if it's even possible to move forward together. As it happens, that kind of situation is not that different than what Paul was writing into in 1 Corinthians. A decade before this letter was written, Paul had visited Corinth and established a church there, but things had kind of gone sideways, and the Corinth that Paul was writing to was a mess. Church leaders were jockeying over position and status and influence. The structure of the church was deeply unequal. Rich members had access to seating and food that was better than poor members. There were disagreements over sexual ethics, over divorce and gender roles. There were a handful of elite leaders, some of those same people that Paul had put in place, who had become annoyingly intellectual. And they missed the forest for the trees. And Paul has a lot to say about all of this, But the sort of crescendo of his argument is this passage that we read tonight. And I must say, I was like deeply not thrilled when I realized that this was the passage that was apparently going to provide the answers that I was looking for. I was like, the wedding passage? Like, I'm going to have to preach this kumbaya sermon about how, like, love is all you need, and it's going to be, like, the passage that all the boring people who can't think of a better reading at their wedding read, and I was, like, really annoyed. Anyway, then I read it, and I reread it, and realized that there's even more to this passage than I had heard at all those weddings. Even calling it the wedding passage, I'm just gonna say, is like some craziness passed down by heteropatriarchy. It's not about romantic love, it's about community. Anyway. Sorry, just had to rant. Had to rant. Okay. What Paul writes here at the top of the passage, like, is radical, was then, is now. He's saying that you can do literally everything right. You can know the right answers, you can make the right moves, but if those answers and actions don't have their roots in love, they're good for nothing. The absence of love makes something that might otherwise be meaningful, like language, into something senseless, like a loud, annoying noise. And then he defines love, and the bar for love is actually quite high. It's patient. It's kind, it doesn't insist on its own way. It rejoices in the truth. It has everlasting hope. Just a momentary bracket here to deal with some of the language around love, that love bears all things, endures all things. That language has been used within the church for a long time to prop up abusive behavior. I believe this is a broken interpretation. I do not believe that it's the intent of the passage, and isn't in any way what I'm about to advocate for here. I think it's important to try to negotiate differences in community, but also that communities have to draw a line at harmful behavior and hold members accountable for it. But okay, back to the definition of love and what it asks us to do. In it, there is a potential map through intense disagreement, one that asks us to put aside our desire to win an argument, to take the time to really see and understand one another, to be honest, and to believe that it is possible to move forward. This is not an easy love. It's a love that requires focus and intention and work to uphold. So here's what happened when my family gathered last summer to try to resolve the fight. Each person was given some time to talk about how the fight had impacted them. We didn't respond to one another, but we did echo back what we had heard each person say. And then we talked about the actual issue, the friends with the harmful opinions, and whether members of my family should be trying to hold them accountable. During this conversation, nobody changed what they thought. This was devastating for me. And for a while, I thought that the whole facilitated peacemaking thing had just been a waste of time. But after the discussion, my family and I went over to my aunt and uncle's house for dinner. And before I left to come back here to New York, my dad suggested that everybody gather around and pray for me. I'd been having a hard time and feeling very alone in my life. Even so, I did not at first want certain members of my conspiracist family to pray for me. But something happened when they did that I can't still entirely put words around. I listened to them say to God all the things they hoped for me and saw that they loved me and it mattered. I was just able to feel close to these people who've known me forever and who can see a part of me that nobody else can. None of us were trying to be right, though trying to be right is often what we do. We were just expressing and receiving care. It was a moment that was both deeply imperfect and deeply meaningful. I shared this story with a friend recently, a wise, brilliant, critical thinking friend. And she said something along the lines of, why should I have to extend an olive branch to these people who don't think I should exist? And of course, I didn't have an answer for her, and I still don't. What I do believe is that Jesus both turned the other cheek and knocked over the money changers' tables. We also need to do both. Knocking over the tables feels better, and it is very clear that that is an action that has a direct relationship to the practice of justice. But finding ways to love in spite of great challenge, that can be just as powerful and more mysterious. I think it allows us to see for a moment a sliver of what God sees in us. We share the sermon at St. Lydia's, so we're going to have a time of silence, and then I'm going to ring the bell again and invite people to share a story that was sparked either by the text or my reflection on it. We share stories, not opinions, because Jesus told stories, and also sharing them helps us to know one another better. So let's take some silence, and then you'll be invited to share.